2 Samuel chapter 18. Last time we spoke, it was 2 Samuel 17. You'll remember that was where Absalom took counsel first from Ahithophel and then from Hushai, whose counsel overturned that of Ahithophel. And now the scene is being set for the battle. Chapter 18 details that battle very briefly. I listened again to the recording afterwards, and I see that I called Ahithophel at one point Abiathar, and then at a later point still I called him Abigail, which is a woman's name. So the same names are the first things to go. Don't know what it was with the Hebrews, but they didn't get very far beyond A when they were thinking of naming their children. And if they did, then they got stuck again at J. It's quite difficult for people like me, for whom names are always tangled. And we've got more A's in this chapter. David was the one that his son Absalom was interested in having killed. He wasn't interested in anybody else. That was his ambition. Whereas Absalom was the one person that David wanted preserved. And at the end of the chapter, it would seem as if he didn't care about anyone else. That is the tension of this chapter. Verse 1, and David numbered the people and were with him, that were with him, and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. And David sent forth a third part of the people under the hand of Joab, and a third part under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and a third part under the hand of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said unto the people, I will surely go forth with you myself also. But the people answered, Thou shalt not go forth, for if we flee away, they will not care for us, neither if half of us die will they care for us. But now thou art worth 10,000 of us, therefore now it is better that thou succour us out of the city. And the king said unto them, What seemeth you best, I will do. And the king stood by the gate side, and all the people came out by hundreds and by thousands. And the king commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, Deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom. So we didn't, in the earlier chapter, really get an impression of how many were with David. Was it a little straggling community? We see now it's far from that. And this is just mentioning the fighting men. And there were thousands of them. David, of course, later was to be in serious trouble for numbering the people. But that, I don't think, is what we have here. The word numbering is different. In verse 1, he's just mustering the company together. And he is determined to go to battle with his men. But he's dissuaded from doing so by the people. On the other hand, Absalom had not intended to go to the battle on the original advice of Ahithophel, but on the advice of Hushai, he does go to the battle. So the plan that was put to Absalom, just go after David, was thwarted. And we'll see that the plan that David had, which was to preserve Absalom, was also going to be thwarted because Absalom was now going to be exposed. So David wanted to go to the battle. The people said, no, you're worth more than 1,000 of us. You stay in the city and succour us. And David took their advice. It's always good, I think, when the leaders of God's people are able to listen to and recognise good advice and not be just autocratic. Good too that David was prepared to go to the battle. Because you remember in chapter 11 where all this trouble started, he had ceased from going out to the battle when it was in an idle moment that he encountered Bathsheba and all these troubles ensued. So David is prepared to go to the battle, but he's restrained from doing so. And he sets up captains of 100, and then he sets up senior captains over 10 such units of 100, so over 1,000. And then over all of them, he sets 3 senior captains. That is Joab, Abishai, and Ittai. He wants to spare his son Absalom. His son is rebellious, and we can't help but reflect and contrast this with the fact that God would not spare his own son, yet his son was obedient, the Lord Jesus. He is described in Song of Solomon 5 verse 10, "My beloved is white and ruddy, the chiefest among 10,000. So David was to stay in the city and he was to succour them. I'd like to think that would mean he'd be on his knees and praying for them. And when he had a chance to encourage them and exhort them, maybe it did. But more likely it meant that he being in the city, he could organise things in Mahanaim, that was the city. He could replenish supplies of weaponry when they needed. Or he could secure the safety of his army if they had in part or in whole to retreat. So he would succour them. We're in a battle. We thought about that many times as we've gone through 1 and 2 Samuel. Spiritual battle, of course. And there is one in heaven who is succouring us, maintaining us with his intercessions to God so that we don't fail. So now we've got an idea of the size of the company with David, and it is many, many thousands, just of the soldiers themselves. And we see how well David relates to his soldiers. He always related well to the people. You know, that's one of the huge differences between him and Saul. And what David does now, he stands at the gate of Mahanaim as all the soldiers are coming out. And so every one of them, he's able in a way to encourage. His eye will engage with them. It's not as if they're fighting for a remote king or a lord that they've only had a glimpse of or perhaps never seen. David is right there with his men. And as they come out, he sees them all and no doubt he's encouraging them. And then he gives an order to his 3 chief captains. He's very straight about this. And it's not only they who hear, but all the people hear. It's obviously given in a loud voice, very, very clearly, that they are to go easy on his son and to spare his life. Well, this is an unusual kind of battle, isn't it? If the chief enemy has to be spared. But this was David's instruction, and they were left in no doubt at all about it. Romans 8 verse 3, verse 32, it says, "He that spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things?" But David wanted to spare his own son. It's remarkable, really, that things had got this far and that God had allowed them to get this far. But sometimes God does allow evil to develop very fully before he intervenes on behalf of his people. In the previous book, we had Saul persecuting David. And the danger came very, very close. David was on the mountain. Saul and his armies were surrounding that mountain or hill. All they had to do really was to go up on all sides and they would encounter him. And yet right at that last minute something happened. God intervened and Saul's army had to leave. So God brings things very close. And you might think, well, why did God allow Absalom to rebel? Why did he allow him to get a following? Why then did he allow a further advance and for Absalom to take the city of Jerusalem? And then why did he allow Absalom to get an army up to come out to David? Well, these are not questions that I can answer, of course. This is the sovereignty of God. And God sometimes brings us into circumstances where opposition develops and problems develop. And it may not be good for our anxiety levels, but it does drive us to prayer, and it does increase our faith when we see that God is well able, even if, humanly speaking, we're defending the last trench, God is able to recover and intervene, as he does here. Well, in this battle, we're going to find that many lose their lives. We'll read on from verse 6. So the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was in the wood of Ephraim, where the people of Israel were slain before the servants of David. And there was a great slaughter that day of 20,000 men. For the battle was there scattered over the face of all the country, and the wood devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. And Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode upon a mule, and the mule went under the thick boughs of a great oak, and his head caught hold of the oak, and he was taken up between the heaven and the earth, and the mule that was under him went away. And a certain man saw it and told Joab, and said, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanged in an oak." And Joab said unto the man that told him, "And behold, thou sawest him, and why didst thou not smite him there to the ground? And I would have given thee 10 shekels of silver and a girdle." And the man said unto Joab, "Though I should receive 1,000 shekels of silver in mine hand, yet would I not put forth mine hand against the king's son. For in our hearing the king charged thee and Abishai and Ittai, saying, Beware that none touch the young man Absalom. Otherwise I should have wrought falsehood against mine own life. For there is no matter hid from the king, and thou thyself wouldest have set thyself against me." So we read, tragically, that 20,000 men lost their lives in the battle. More, apparently, too, in the woods. All because of Absalom, his vanity, and his self-ambition. And I wonder how many good men, I mean, Christians, have lost their spiritual lives, in a sense, through following charismatic but misguided and self-ambitious leaders. You know, the kind of thing, men for some reason or other, they like to have a leader. The assembly isn't structured quite like that, as we know, but they like a leader, like a strong leader, and if it's someone charismatic, then they are apt to follow him. And there are these men that are very willing to take this place, and their ambitions exceed by far what God ever intended for them. And people are dragged down by following them in their cause. It's very clear that God's hand is in this battle, that it was not just the superior fighting skills of David's men. And the evidence of that is that many were devoured in the wood. Whether that means they were just bogged down and caught up, I don't know, but the word devoured is the same as before, and it does seem as if, for one reason or another, they actually lost their lives in the wood. And at least, if they did die, it wasn't at the hand of their brethren, it was by the divine hand. This would be a very thick wood. It was populated with oak trees and terebinths, both of which are very large and spreading trees, low branches. And there was Absalom, his long hair, his pride and joy, riding out heroically, cutting a dashing figure, his hair blowing free in the wind. And it was going to be that very object of his vanity, his hair, that was going to be the end of him. Because it caught in a branch, and he was left hanging as the mule went off and left him there. And now that which he was so fond of and so proud of, I suppose he must have cursed it, because there was nothing he could do. He was just trapped and completely exposed to the enemy. Galatians 3 verse 13 says, "For cursed is every one that hangeth on a tree." And it's clearly providential judgment here that God has allowed this to happen, and Absalom is there hanging. Of course, God's own son was hung on a tree. In the case of Absalom, it was pride and rebellion that caused him to hang. But the Lord Jesus Christ, of course, it was his humbleness and his obedience that put him on the tree. This man, we're not given his name, but he is obviously very loyal to David. I like him, and this, he is typical of the tremendous loyalty that David tended to inspire among his people. And what a contrast he was with Joab. Joab was a maverick. You know, he would do what he thought was best. There are lots of different characters all the way through 1 and 2 Samuel. Joab is an interesting one, and he fits a certain type. He was a maverick. Couldn't really be told. This other man, he had the opportunity to kill Absalom. He could have got glory, he could have got reward, but there was no way he was going to touch him, because he knew this was the king's son, and the son had given strict instruction that Absalom should not be hurt. So here he is, a conscientious and obedient man, a man of integrity, and he puts the desire to please his Lord, the small L, David, before any desire for riches. Are we like that? Is that true of us? That our first ambition in life is to please the Lord, not to better ourselves, not to get as big a share of this world as we can. But that is our motive. There'll be a reward in heaven, of course. The other man, what a contrast. He is disobedient, and also, as we're going to see, he is hasty. Verse 14, let's read on. "Then said Joab, I may not tarry thus with thee. And he took 3 darts in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And 10 young men that bare Joab's armour compassed about and smote Absalom and slew him. And Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing after Israel, for Joab held back the people. And they took Absalom and cast him into a great pit in the wood, and laid a very great heap of stones upon him. And all Israel fled, every one to his tents." Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and reared up for himself a pillar, which is in the king's dale. For he said, "I have no son to keep my name in remembrance." And he called the pillar after his own name, and it is called unto this day Absalom's place. Joab, you remember, was the one who orchestrated the return of Absalom to David. He must have been regretting that now, I think, as he saw the trouble that had been stirred up. And now he's talking to this man, he's come to report to Joab to say that he's seen Absalom there hanging, trapped and alive in the tree. Joab remonstrates with him, and as this man gives his speech about his loyalty to David, Joab becomes very frustrated and impatient. In effect, he says, "I can't waste time talking to you." And so off he goes in his haste to kill Absalom. Proverbs 29 verse 20 says, "Seest thou a man that is hasty in his words? There is more hope of a fool than of him." It's not good to be hasty. There are people whose nature is to be very hasty. Quick judgments. They don't weigh things up carefully. They are hasty. Well, there's more hope of a fool. You might be able to reason with a fool. You might be able to turn him round. You might be able to save him, but not the hasty man. And here's Joab. He's the man who killed Abner earlier against David's will. And he is as self-willed now as he ever was. Probably he reasons to leave this man alive would be dangerous. He's only going to continue to be a threat to David or to David's nominated successor, Solomon, whoever it might be. And so, with what we would today call rail politic, he's going to kill him. And he goes and thrusts three darts into Absalom's bosom, or his heart. Three army divisions, three darts, and Absalom is David's third son. I don't know whether David ever knew that Joab was the one who did this, or whether the evidence was obscured. I've looked in Kings to see, and I can't see it clearly that David did know. He doesn't specifically mention it, apparently. After this deed, then Joab does show, along with being a pragmatic soldier, he shows some statesmanship. And as he blows the horn, he calls off the fight. He doesn't take the opportunity, now he's got the upper hand, to continue to harry and to fight and to destroy the opposing forces. But he calls in his men and the battle is over. And so further bloodshed has been halted. So the good things about Joab as well as bad. And when Absalom died, then all the support melted away. Same was true with Saul, the trouble he gave to David. But when he died, then all the problems, well, almost all of them, melted away, and David was able to reign. But when the Lord died, that didn't happen. His supporters didn't melt away. You might remember in Acts chapter 5, Gamaliel giving his advice is very well respected. And he gave two examples of previous uprisings where, when they died, their followers all disappeared. And he said that we can safely see the same thing happen here, unless it be of God. We'd ought to be fighting against God. We find that, although as far as they knew, the Lord had died, and that was the end of it, they didn't believe the resurrection. His men, his followers, increased and were strengthened. Just the opposite of what we have here. Because, of course, the Lord is risen. So here is Absalom. He's been exalting himself. He reached his ambition. He just wanted now to destroy his father. And he goes from all this self-exaltation to a deep pit. And the pit is filled with stones. It was deep somewhere in the woods. We don't read of any attempt to find him and to rebury him. Other dignitaries who had died in battle would be buried or reburied, whatever. But Absalom just died in this indignity, in a pit. And he was, I suppose, a very important man. I think 106 times his name is mentioned in Scripture, something like that. And he was an important man, and he went out of this life. What do you have? A pit. Few of us are going to be ever attaining to the fame of Absalom. But what do we have when we go out? There is a pit, there is heaven. We need to be trusting the Lord and following him. When they buried the Lord, of course, they put a big stone across the tomb. And that, they thought, was going to secure the body against any attempt to remove it and to pretend that there'd been a resurrection. Of course, the stone was nothing. The mighty angel came and just rolled it aside and sat on it contemptuously to show that the tomb was empty. The stone could never stop the Lord. He just went out through the tomb, notwithstanding the stone being there. But here a great pile of stones are put upon this pit. Earlier, you remember, there were two men, they were spies on David's side, and they had to hide in a well, and that well was covered with a cloth, and corn was put on it, and a woman pretended that she was just working there with the corn. But now here is the cause of that need to hide. Absalom, and he himself is in a very deep pit, and that pit is covered with stones. The battle's ended. All Israel flee, that is, all those with Absalom, and they go to their tents. These, of course, would be the soldiers' tents, temporary structures while they are engaging in the battle. And then it gives us a little note about this pillar that Absalom had erected. At one stage, he had three sons, 2 Samuel chapter 14, verse 27 tells us, and evidently, for whatever reason, they didn't live for long. So, and maybe that was a good thing in a way, so Solomon would not suffer an uprising when he took the throne from that quarter. And at some point, apparently during Absalom's rejection, these sons must have died, and Absalom thought, well, there's a danger of me going out without any successor or without any recognition. So he built this big pillar, I presume it would be big, and he named it after himself. But where is that pillar now? Who knows? He's not remembered by a pillar. He's remembered for his rebellion, and all he had was a heap of stones in a pit. Of course, this was a dreadful waste of a young life. Even more so was it a waste of those soldiers, the 20,000, and maybe more than that number who died in the woods. What a waste all that was. And although not every one of those men would have been faithful, they do typically stand for the people of God. And you know, and I know, that you get infighting between the people of God. Should never happen, and it only happens because of the flesh, and because there isn't that submission to God, and there isn't that working of the Spirit and the fruit of the Spirit that there should be. And sometimes, and maybe quite often, I think in the assemblies are some who have never been saved, and they might be incurably religious, but their appetites in the end are carnal, and so we get battles. The scripture says, if ye bite and devour one another, take heed lest ye be consumed. And that was what was happening here in Israel. What a waste, all these men in this worthless cause. What a waste that noble advisor, Ahithophel, who went seeing his counsel was rejected and hanged himself. Then verse 19, can read on. Then said Ahimaaz, there's another A, the son of Zadok, let me now run and bear the king's tidings, how that the Lord hath avenged him of his enemies. And Joab said unto him, thou shalt not bear tidings this day, but thou shalt bear tidings another day. But this day thou shalt bear no tidings, because the king's son is dead. Then said Joab to Cushi, go tell the king what thou hast seen. And Cushi bowed himself unto Joab and ran. Then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, yet again to Joab, but howsoever, let me, I pray thee, also run after Cushi. And Joab said, wherefore wilt thou run, my son, seeing that thou hast no tidings ready? But howsoever, said he, let me run. And he said unto him, Run. Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain, and overran Cushi. And David sat between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gates unto the wall, and lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man running alone. And the watchman cried and told the king. And the king said, If he be alone, there is tidings in his mouth. And he came apace and drew near. And the watchman saw another man running. And the watchman called unto the porter and said, Behold, another man running alone. And the king said, He also bringeth tidings. And the watchman said, Methinketh the running of the foremost is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, He is a good man, and cometh with good tidings. So here's Ahimaaz. It seems he wants to curry favour with David, but he only wants to bring good news, just the positive side. He wants to tell him how the battle has been won. He had been specifically told by Joab that Absalom was dead. But he was not going to tell David that. And he wasn't the man that Joab wanted to send. It was Cushi. That is true in preaching today's, when it comes to serious evangelism. There are some people who are gifted for that and are sent. There are others that want to do it for whatever reason. Maybe, you know, to get attention to themselves. But they're not sent. And very likely their message won't be a faithful one. It will be diluted. And they achieve very little if in fact they don't actually achieve harm. Ahimaaz, you may remember, the son of Zadok, he came into prominence as David's message bearer. He was one of those men that was hiding in the well. But now Joab didn't want to use him. Some people can't face rejection like that. You know, they really want to be recognized and appreciated and loved and in the forefront. So he kept begging with Joab until it became embarrassing. Please send me, let me go as well. And eventually Joab relented, but Cushi had already got a head start on him. But unfortunately, Ahimaaz outran Cushi. And so, although he was not the messenger that Joab sent, he was the faster runner, and he was the first with the news. And he came to Mahanaim, where we read about two gates. David was there by the two gates. Mahanaim itself means two companies. And of course, in this chapter, there are two kings, two armies, and now two runners. And here comes Ahimaaz, one of the two young men in the spy network. And he had brought helpful and good news to David before. And David's instinct is to say, this is good. He's going to bring favourable news. But you know, favourable news isn't always faithful news. And we've got here in Ahimaaz another of the character studies of 1 and 2 Samuel, of someone who is keen to be used, keen to bring a message, but not faithful in every detail. Telling people what they want to hear, what they have to say, isn't necessarily untrue, but it's not balanced. And we see that today, don't we? And the result of it is that there are confused messages when it comes to the gospel. Proverbs 26, verse 28 is something good to say on this. First reading, it might sound very surprising. A lying tongue hateth those that are afflicted by it, and a flattering mouth worketh ruin. And there are many preachers, some are lying, some are flattering, or both. And Proverbs says of those preachers that they hate their hearers. Well, you think that's odd, do they? Well, yes, they do. Because if they love their hearers, they would tell them the truth. You know, and you may be a faithful witness to the gospel. We've all got opportunities to speak. We're not all evangelists, but to speak to our acquaintances and our neighbours and others. And when we tell them the truth, sometimes we get very stern reactions, unpleasant reactions. And we brought a message which ought to have been good news, that's what the gospel means, and yet we're despised for it, and we made ourselves unpopular. But never can it be said that we hate our hearers. We've given them what they need. Whereas the flatterer, the one who only nudges at the truth and doesn't tell them the whole thing, he hates his hearers. Because he's not concerned really for their eventual spiritual welfare. And because of preachers like that, millions of people are going into judgment and to hell. Verse 28. And Ahimaaz called and said unto the king, all is well. And he fell down to the earth upon his face before the king and said, blessed be the Lord thy God, which hath delivered up the men that lifted up their hand against my lord the king. And the king said, is the young man Absalom safe? And Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant and me thy servant, I saw a great tumult, but I knew not what it was. And the king said unto him, turn aside and stand here. And he turned aside and stood still, and behold, Cushi came. And Cushi said, tidings, my lord the king, for the Lord hath avenged thee this day of all them that rose up against thee. And the king said unto Cushi, is the young man Absalom safe? And Cushi answered, the enemies of my lord the king, and all that rise up against thee to do thee hurt, be as that young man is. And the king was much moved, and went up to the chamber over the gate, and wept. And as he went, thus he said, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son. So here come these two men. One is unfaithful and partial. His message, the other is faithful. The first says, all is well. All was not well. And when he tells David all is well, David seems to brush that aside. He makes no inquiry about the battle. He is only concerned, apparently, for the well-being of his enemy's son. Not concerned, apparently, for the well-being of his loyal supporters and the soldiers. Well, Ahimaaz has brought a partial message. David hasn't been able to tell because Ahimaaz pretends that he doesn't know what's happened to Absalom. As I say, where we bring a message, there are many who want to bring the good news. They don't want to bring along with it any kind of warning. So you've got a balanced presentation of the whole truth. And the result of that kind of a message, it just leads to indifference. People don't care. They think everything's going to be all right. And even to contempt. And the gospel is good news. And it says in Romans that the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. But also in Romans it says the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. So there's no point in bringing the good news if we don't make it clear why that news must be received and believed, because the wrath of God is abiding on those that do not believe. So we get this insipid travesty of the gospel where men say, smile, God loves you. It's not even popular. It just makes the Christian look contemptible and foolish. and it misrepresents God, and it sends its hearers to hell instead of saving them. So Ahimaaz talks about having been sent. Well, he wasn't exactly sent. It was just Job was probably so fed up. He had enough on his mind that he got rid of him. And off he went. He wasn't sent. But then Cushi speaks. And Cushi starts again with the favourable side of things. The Lord hath avenged thee this day. And then the king straightly asks him, again he's not too interested in the battle, he's concerned about his son, straightly asks him, what about Absalom, is he safe, the young man? And Cushi tells him, not in a brutal way, very, very tactful is this Cushi, I think, but he brings what was bad, devastating news to David in this very carefully worded way, the enemies of my lord the king and all that rise against thee to do thee hurt, be as that young man is. That's all David needed to know, and he went up into the chamber weeping and repeating the name of his son over and over. When he heard that the battle had gone well, David seemed to show no reaction, no interest almost. Now he hears that things have gone badly for his son. We see a very strong reaction. What are we to make of that? Well, you might say David was a father. Isn't that good that he felt for his son? Well, yes, must be the answer to that. It must. But David wasn't just a father. He was also a king. He was a ruler. And he had the nation to think about, as well as his family. And there were men there that had been loyal to him and hazarded their lives. And here was a son that for whatever reason was rebellious, disobedient, wanted his father dead. And David only cares for his son. Go into verse 1 of chapter 19. Let's read down a little bit. And it was told Joab, behold, the king weepeth and mourneth for Absalom. And the victory that day was turned into mourning unto all the people. And the people heard say that day how the king was grieved for his son. And the people gat them by stealth that day into the city, as people being ashamed steal away when they flee in battle. But the king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, O my son Absalom! O Absalom, my son, my son. This ought to have been a time of rejoicing. The battle had been won swiftly, with a minimum, really, of deaths. It could have been a whole lot worse. The rebellion had been put down. Now should be the time of joy to release all that tension of the battle. But what happens? Those that are victors creeping back into the city of Mahanaim. Again, they're going past the king, as they had when he went out. And they can hear, he's in the chamber above the gates, and they can hear him wailing and sobbing and repeating the name of his son. And they feel ashamed. Yet they've hazarded their lives. When had a battle ever been like this before, which being won was not a cause of jubilation, but a cause where the victors should feel shame? And all David could think about was his son. Never mind that his son was a murderer, there's a rebel, disobedient to his father, that he was an adulterer, taking his father's concubines, that he was a liar, he was covetous, he was a thief. Never mind all those things. And it seemed, of course, to his followers that David was slighting them. They'd expected David to be pleased that the enemy had been overcome. Well, David, of course, what happened to him, in a sense, it was unutterably sad, no doubt. But he was asking for favorable treatment for his son. Had it been anybody else who'd risen up against David, he would not have asked for that favorable treatment, nor could he. That would be the enemy, and the enemy would have to be destroyed. Just bringing that into the assembly again, it's always a sad thing if an elder has a child who goes astray in a serious way, you know, who's already in fellowship themselves. But because it's the son or the daughter of an elder, are they to be treated any differently from anyone else in the assembly? Well, you know the answer to that. And sometimes elders have had to read out the reason why their own daughter or son has to be put away. And that must be very, very hard. But there, you see, it's honouring to the assembly to be impartial. And David was not being impartial. And there are assemblies where this partiality and favouritism, because it's in the family, have been split through. Particularly where maybe an assembly comprises just two families or something like that. There should not be partiality where it comes to things requiring discernment and judgment among the people of God. And just to finish now, verse 5 to 8. And Joab came into the house to the king and said, "Thou hast shamed this day the faces of all thy servants, which this day have saved thy life, and the lives of thy sons and of thy daughters, and the lives of thy wives and the lives of thy concubines, in that thou lovest thine enemies and hatest thy friends. For thou hast declared this day that thou regardest neither princes nor servants. For this day I perceive that if Absalom had lived, and all we had died this day, then it had pleased thee well. Now therefore arise, go forth and speak comfortably unto thy servants. For I swear by the Lord, if thou go not forth, there will not tarry one with thee this night. And that will be worse unto thee than all the evil that befell thee from thy youth until now." Then the king arose and sat in the gate. And they told unto all the people, saying, "Behold, the king doth sit in the gate." And all the people came before the king. For Israel had fled every man to his tent. I would think partly David's problem was he knew that all this had befallen because of his impropriety with Bathsheba. And we got this interesting man, Joab. He's a maverick, as we know. He's disobedient. But in a way, he acted as an impartial soldier would towards the enemy. And now he's come into David, and we can see the fury brimming up and boiling over in Joab. No surprise, really. And he's telling a few home truths to the king. And David had shown that he put his son before the country, despite Absalom's appalling behaviour. In this, as in other little incidents throughout Samuel, we don't see the Spirit actually give us an analysis of what is right and what is wrong. It's left to the spiritual leaders, the spiritual readers, to discern that. And I think that it's probably quite difficult to pick our way through what is right and wrong in all this. And my conclusion may well differ from yours. On the one hand, Joab should not have disobeyed a clear order. If he had a problem with it, the time to say so was at the time the order was given. He ought to have obeyed David. But on the other hand, David should not have given such an order, showing favoritism. But then again, David did require that Absalom should be allowed to live. And providentially, God so arranged things that Absalom was caught by his hair, and it would have been wholly possible to have preserved his life, and yet to take him captive and to bring the battle to a conclusion. So those are the different considerations. David, he couldn't see anything of the national victory here. All he could see was he'd lost his son, and he was going to mourn and weep for a long time, no doubt. He must have known that this was all the fulfillment of Nathan's prophecy. I think it was the final playing out of Nathan's prophecy, that because of what he did with Bathsheba, that trouble would afflict his house. And we could ask David again, was it worth it, that infidelity? Well, surely it was not, as he's seen the sad consequences. And now, David, he's got to come out to the people. He's got to start this process of recovery and the rebuilding of Israel.